From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Lisa Kudrow is in the middle of the final season of Friends. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with her about performing in one of the most successful sitcoms of the past decade, creating the character of Phoebe, and creating characters that are nothing like Phoebe. She's currently starring with Val Kilmer in the film Wonderland, based on the story of ex-porn star Johnny Wadd. Lisa Kudrow, coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. At least 10 people have died in 5 Israeli air raids in the Gaza Strip today. 2 members of the militant Hamas faction are among the dead. Palestinians said dozens of people were wounded. The Israeli army said it destroyed a suspected weapons workshop. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon said there would be more raids to, quote, liquidate terror organizations. The Islamic movements Hamas and Islamic Jihad vowed revenge for today's Gaza attacks. One U.S. soldier was killed today in an ambush near the town of Fallujah in Iraq. NPR's Jackie Leiden reports from Baghdad.
The latest U.S. soldier's death occurred as a 30-man foot patrol, followed by 5 military vehicles, approached the main bridge into Fallujah. A bomb exploded, and then the patrol came under fire. When it was over, 1 soldier lay dead and 5 were wounded. 2 civilian truck drivers were also caught in the crossfire and taken to the hospital, one of them a Syrian truck driver. Just Sunday, soldiers were attacked in Fallujah when their convoy came under fire. Elsewhere in the country today, the United States military arrested 4 high-level Ba'ath Party members and a Republican Guard officer who they say were arming insurgents. The U.S. also found a major weapons cache near Baghdad. Jackie Leiden, NPR News, Baghdad.
A federal judge in Maryland has released Nathaniel Heatwall on his own recognizance. The FBI says Heatwall has admitted to sneaking box cutters and other weapons onto airliners. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
The FBI affidavit says the 20-year-old college student illegally brought packages containing matches, bleach, and box cutters onto 6 different aircraft beginning last February. On 4 of those occasions, Heatwall left packages behind, along with a note telling authorities that he'd been able to slip past airport security with items that were prohibited. According to authorities, Heatwall also sent an email in September informing the Transportation Security Administration what he'd done, but agents did not find the items until last week. In the note, Heatwall said he knew his actions were illegal, but said this was an act of civil disobedience with the aim of improving public safety for the air-traveling public. The U.S. attorney in the case told the judge he is not interested in putting Heatwall in jail. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
Washington-area sniper suspect John Allen Muhammad surprised those at his trial today by asking to represent himself and dismiss his lawyers. The judge allowed it and said the attorneys will be available on a standby basis. In his opening statement, Muhammad said he had nothing to do with the sniper shootings that terrorized Washington-area residents for 3 weeks in the fall of 2002. Muhammad is charged in the killing of Dean Harold Myers at a Virginia gas station. The Dow Jones Industrial Average finished up 56 points today at 97.78 in moderate trading of nearly 1.2 billion shares. The Nasdaq closed up 12 at 19.25. The S&P 500 was up 5 points at 1,044. This is NPR News. CIA officials say they think a tape attributed to Osama bin Laden and broadcast over the weekend is probably authentic. The tape aired Saturday on Arab TV channel Al Jazeera. The CIA says it believes the voice is that of Osama bin Laden and was probably recorded recently. The tape urges Iraqis to wage holy war against the U.S. At least 2 people have been killed and dozens more injured in 2 grenade attacks in Indian-administered Kashmir. No group has claimed responsibility. Veer Singh reports from New Delhi.
The first explosion occurred when unidentified men lobbed a grenade at security forces at a crowded bus terminal in Srinagar, the main town in India's northern state of Jammu and Kashmir. The grenade missed its target and instead injured more than 30 people who were waiting to board buses. At least 7 people were injured in the second grenade attack, which took place in the town of Anantnag, about 35 miles south of Srinagar. India blames Pakistan for supporting an increasingly violent campaign by armed rebels fighting to end New Delhi's rule in Kashmir. Pakistan denies the charge. Tensions have increased since the two nuclear-armed countries engaged in a bitter exchange at the United Nations last month. For NPR News, I'm Veer Singh in New Delhi.
Basketball star Kobe Bryant must stand trial for sexual assault. A judge in Eagle, Colorado, made the ruling today. Bryant is accused of raping a 19-year-old woman on June 30th. He doesn't deny the two had sex, but said it was consensual. Bryant could face a life sentence if he's convicted. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Kresge Foundation, building capacity with challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of The Normal One, Life with a Difficult or Damaged Sibling, by Jean Safer, Ph.D.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Maybe you already know this. Lisa Kudrow is not like Phoebe, the quirky character she plays on Friends. And she certainly wasn't like Phoebe in the film she's best known for, The Opposite of Sex, in which she played a very smart, hyperverbal, and neurotic single woman. What that film and Friends do have in common is that Kudrow is very funny in both. She's also been in the comedies Analyze This and Romy and Michelle's High School Reunion. Now she's in the middle of the final season of Friends, and she's starring in the dramatic film Wonderland, which is based on the story of the porn star Johnny Wadd, who was considered to be one of the most well-endowed men in the business. The movie begins after his film career has ended, when he's addicted to drugs and implicated in a multiple murder. Lisa Kudrow plays his estranged wife. In this scene, he shows up at her door and tells her that he plans to enter the Witness Protection Program, but he wants to take her and his teenaged girlfriend with him.
Okay. They've offered me a deal, and I think I'm going to take it. Okay. They're going to put me in the Witness Protection Program if I tell them everything I told you, except I told them I'm not saying anything about anything unless all three of us can go.
All three of us?
And they agreed.
Wait, who's all three of us?
You, me, and Dawn. We can go tomorrow.
No, I'm not going anywhere tomorrow. No,
Sharon, it's okay. They've got people that can come and pack you.
No, John, no, I am not going into the Witness Protection Program with you. That's that.
Yes.
No.
Yes, no. Sharon, this is the new start.
No,
listen, this is the new start.
We're starting. Listen.
Sharon, everything that we planned could happen now, okay?
I don't want a fresh start with you, John. Wake up.
Oh, listen.
Okay? No, you listen. I am through supporting you. What do you think? I would just leave and never see my family again?
Sharon.
You've gone too far
now,
this time,
hang on a second.
Pal.
If you don't help me with this, I am dead.
You're already dead.
Listen, this one last thing is all I'm asking for. You've got to do it.
Stop it, John.
Lisa Kudrow and Val Kilmer in a scene from Wonderland. Lisa Kudrow, welcome to Fresh Air. Did you have any awareness of who Johnny Wadd was back when he was a porn star?
I have an older brother and an older sister. And
yeah.
But I had, definitely heard about Johnny Wadd from especially my older brother.
Is he going to be sorry that you said that?
I don't know. You know, at the premiere there was a, I don't remember his name, but there was some porn star. And all the men knew who he was.
So did you feel like now you have to watch his movies, you know,
no,
in preparation?
Not at all. I do not feel that I have to watch any movies. And I didn't for the movie.
Do you know if his wife did? Because, you know, you're playing his wife, and I know you met her before, before making the film. And
yeah.
And that's about the time she left him.
Shortly after. Yeah, shortly after this movie. I think, you know, I don't know if she ever divorced him. I can't remember now. She may not have.
Uh-huh.
But I don't think she saw the movies.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that she did. And, you know, she didn't know that he was even in that industry for 2 years into his career. Shouldn't know what he was doing.
What does that tell you about the character?
Hers or his?
Hers.
Hers.
The one you're playing.
Well, no, it told me a lot about her. Mostly there were just a lot of questions about her for me.
What kind of questions? But
how does a woman stay with a man who's in an industry that repulses you? And then how do you stay with a man who has a 15-year-old girlfriend? There were a lot of questions for me, for her. But in reading the script, I felt like they were being answered anyway. But that's just what made it interesting to me. Not that I had questions. It's just that's what made it complicated to me. And the truth is, I did understand the justifications a person can, you know, create for themselves to be in that situation.
Excuse me if this is in bad taste, but I feel like I just have to ask. Did you ask his wife what it was like to be married with, you know, to be married to the person who might be the most endowed man in America?
No, I never asked. I didn't bring it up.
Bad taste?
I felt like it was. Yeah. I'm not judging you. I just felt like... It wasn't part of this story, and it wasn't what I needed to know.
Right.
You know, then I would just be indulging some curiosity that was, you know, none of my business, really.
You know, another interesting thing about the character that you play, at least the way you play her, is that it's on the one hand somebody who's had to really live a life in denial in some ways.
Yes.
And at the same time, she seems to be very much like in control kind of person who's really into like drawing the line and saying no. But at the same time, when he shows up at the door all bloodied, you know, she lets him in and tries to take care of him.
Yes.
And then throws him out.
Yes.
So
actually, he stayed over that night. Mm. They didn't show that, but yeah, he even slept over that night.
So it's a really complicated character.
It's very complicated character, very. But I understand denial, and I'm a fan of denial. So I understood that, and I also understood, and also after I met with her, it was very clear that, you know, Sharon had rules. She had a code that she lived by, and one of them was you don't abandon someone that you're married to, and you made a commitment to someone, and you stay with it. And I think that was sort of the bottom line for her. And that also was what made her so angry about, you know, his behavior just put her in situations that went against her grain and totally, deeply. And that's what made her so angry at him. But she stayed with him.
Tell me what you liked about the script and why you decided to do it. It's a script that has... You know, the story is about, you know, pornography, drugs, murder, you know, people who are very damaged in one way or another. A lot of people know you from, like, comedy, you know, from Friends. What did you like about the script when you read it?
I liked the way they were telling the story about these murders, and no one was convicted of these murders, and you had two versions of what happened that night. And they were both unreliable. And that was interesting to me. And I also loved how much the script, and I think they did it in the movie, was really underscoring how desperate and pathetic all these people were. Especially the people who were just so far gone into their addictions that they weren't even human beings anymore. You know, that's what fascinated me. And just that it's all a little more complicated. It wasn't so black and white, cut and dry, and good and evil, you know.
Lisa Kudrow is my guest, and she's starring in the new film Wonderland. Let's talk about Friends a little bit and your character of Phoebe. What was that character like at the very, very start when you were given the script, you were told about the character?
Mm-hmm. Well, what I liked about the character and what was written was they had this monologue in the pilot where she talks about how... she left home when she was 14. Her mother had killed herself. Her stepfather was in prison. She lived in an abandoned car. All these things that were not even a little bit funny. And I just thought, wow, the only way this works is if this girl doesn't think any of these are a problem or, you know, they weren't traumatic to her. It's that, you know, other side of denial where it's everything's okay. It's all just okay. And if you sell it as okay, everybody will, you know, no one will feel sad about it. And that was interesting to me. That I loved that, that there was this person who had these horrible things, and that's not the part of reality she's living in, you know, the horror of it.
I think the word probably most often used to describe her is ditzy.
Yeah, that came up a lot.
Does that word work for you?
Sure. Sure. Not so much now. I don't know why. Now I feel like there's just so many more times that she's being sarcastic and calling people on their stuff, making fun of them, whereas before she took everything at face value, and that's where some of the comedy came from, you know.
So she's gotten smarter in that sense.
Yeah. It makes sense to me, because since the beginning of the show, she's met her real mother, dealt with her father, done a lot of things.
Now, Friends has been TV's most watched sitcom. How does that translate to how viewers respond to you? Because, you know, let's face it, lots of people watch it. It's really easy to be on TV now and feel like nobody's watching because there's so many stations. But, I mean, that's certainly not true of Friends.
Oh, you know, in the beginning, people would meet me and just treat me like I was this, like a performer at their kid's birthday party, sort of. You know what I mean? Just, oh, hey, and I know you'll want to do this, like dying to perform any opportunity I can. Hey, do the smelly kitty song, you know, every time I met someone. That was always funny to me, just thinking that I would love to. I can't wait to.
So what's a nice way of diplomatically telling them, not a chance?
Yeah, just giggling. And so, no, I can't do that. And sometimes I'd even make, when they'd get really persistent, I'd make up something about, you know, I'm really not allowed. Because that's property of Warner Brothers, and I'm not allowed. I'll look into it. You know what? Because people ask, this comes up a lot. I need to find out if I can do this or not. I don't know. I go to great lengths.
That's very clever. On the season opener of Friends, this season, you've just reunited with your old boyfriend, played by Paul Rudd, while vacationing in the Caribbean. And on the flight home, you find out that he actually has a girlfriend. And I want to play that scene on the flight home.
Okay. You know, once we're in the air and the captain turns off the seatbelt sign, you feel free to roam about my cabin.
You should be careful when checking your overhead bins. Because items may shift during the...
Oh, you're not good at this.
You don't have to go home tonight, do you?
No, I think I could come over. Saturday, right?
Oh.
What?
I can't do anything tonight.
Why not?
I have a date.
You have a date? With who?
Oh, it's my girlfriend.
You have a girlfriend?
Yeah. Well, when you and I broke up, I started seeing someone.
Well, for how long?
3 months.
3 months? Okay. This is probably none of my business, but how long do you think you're going to keep seeing her?
I'll tell her that it's over tonight at dinner. I promise.
Oh, okay. Good. You do that. And then when you get home, maybe there'll be a special delivery package waiting for you.
Maybe I'll sign for it. Tear it open. Pull out the packing material.
You know what? We're going to have sex. Let's just leave it there.
That's Lisa Kudrow and Paul Rudd in a scene from this season's opening episode of Friends. Your timing, your comic timing is so good. And I'm just wondering, you know, talk about intuitive. Is that something that's intuitive or something that you worked on, that you were trained in?
Oh, I think it's intuitive. I go back and forth on it because I think every actor, I think everybody has the capacity for comedy, and everybody has the capacity for acting. But I don't know. I think this is interesting to me. I took a, you know, I was involved with the Groundlings, which is an improvisational sketch comedy group in L.A. And in one of the classes, there was this actor who had worked a lot and really good actor. And he was having a little trouble with the comedy, he felt. That's why he was taking this class. And he asked me at one point, you know, you just, I don't know how to do it. And you're doing it and you're funny and I want to do that. And I don't know why, but somehow I knew. I said, yeah, but you're an actor. Just be in the scene and listen and then just respond. And I think it'll be funny. And he did, and it got funny. He stopped trying. He relaxed into the comedy. And it feels like that's all it is. It's, you got to just relax into... The more you're relaxed, the funnier it can be. The more open you are. I don't know. I tell you, I'm really inarticulate about this stuff.
Right, yeah. Well, I'm not agreeing with you that you're
right,
articulate.
Yeah, you
but
are. Yeah. Yeah, you are. I heard it. Yeah.
My guest is Lisa Kudrow, one of the stars of Friends. She's starring in the new movie, Wonderland. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Many public radio stations around the country are fundraising today, including yours. Public radio's programming is unique. In-depth news, long-form interviews, uninterrupted by commercials. The only reason why we can maintain this unique programming is that we're funded in large part by our listeners. Your pledge helps ensure your station's future. Please call now. Thank you. My guest Lisa Kudrow is one of the stars of Friends, which is in its final season, and she's starring in the new film, Wonderland. How do you feel about this being the last season of Friends? Is that a good thing for you?
It's a mixed bag of emotions. You know, I love TV. I like a TV schedule a lot, and I love everybody I'm working with, and it's a good show. People like it. People watch it. That's all good. But it's fine that it's time to move on. I mean, honestly, I can't see doing this for another 10 years. You know, it has to end at some point. This is as good a time as any.
What are some of the things that you think you'll miss and some of the things you won't?
I'll miss, you know, those five actors and, you know, the executive producers I've become, you know, friendly with. I don't know that I'll miss, and I think I'll even miss Phoebe or being her, you know, like putting on that person, because that's what it feels like. I'd want to say putting on those clothes, but not literally, because I actually hate the clothes. But just putting on that skin of Phoebe, I'll miss that.
What do you hate about the clothes?
How unflattering they are, maybe, number one. It's not my style at all. But, and it's always tights, you know. I hate pulling up tights. It's very silly little things. But I don't know. I'll miss it. And in a way, I've missed the Phoebe that she started off being, to be honest. Anyway, I miss being so, you know, unreasonably optimistic and cheerful about absolutely everything. Because that was nice. That was a nice thing to do every day.
Is it kind of a relief from yourself to do that?
Yes, and a little of it seeps in, and I think it helps you cope with other things in your life better.
Really?
Yeah. That's why I actually have a hard time, you know, defining anyone as stupid or, you know, ditzy or any of that, because it's an easier life, and it maybe isn't so stupid.
Is there anything in your life that you feel really connects to the lives of the characters on Friends? You know, like, did you ever have, like, friends walking in and out of your house all the time and a small group of people that knew everything about each other and that were lovers with each other and all that stuff?
No, not even in college. That was never part of my experience. to be honest, no.
Did you have lots of friends, or were you more on your own?
Not on my own. I've always had like a few good friends at a time, and then some acquaintances, you know. But no, I never really had that core group of men and women, you know, that were just friends, because I actually never really believed that. I honestly don't know that men actually like to be friends with women. Maybe they do now. Maybe they're different. But, you know, back when I was in college, it seemed like men were really only friends with women if there was a chance of, you know, some sex.
Mm-hmm.
But so, no, it really wasn't ever my experience.
Do you know how the series is going to end?
No, I don't. But I just read something where Marta Kaufman, one of the creators, said she hopes everyone's going to be happy. The characters, where all these people that we've known for 10 years are going to be happy. So it won't be like everyone dies or, you know, one of those. It was a dream. No, I think everyone's going to end up being happy.
You know, there's been like a whole industry of shows inspired by Friends. And, I mean, there are times, and it's been like this for years, when you put on the TV and you feel like every half hour there's a new group of people in their 20s or 30s sitting on a couch talking to each other and having affairs with each other.
Yeah.
Is that bizarre for you to watch?
In the beginning it was. Not bizarre, I just thought, wow. It was flattering. To be honest, it was flattering. And then a little sad, because I think TV does this all the time. I just read something the creator of Everyone Loves Raymond said, that they think that you're establishing a new formula for TV success. And you're not. You've just hit on something with, you know, the casting, and they click with the writer's sensibilities, and you've created people and lots of backstory for these people. So they feel fleshed out, and that's what it is. It's not just, oh, let's just put six, you know, young people in a room. See what happens.
Right. Now, you got the role of Phoebe on Friends after initially getting the role of Roz on the show Frasier. She's the producer of Frasier's radio show, the role now played by Perry Gilpin. And then you lost the role before the series actually started. What happened?
I'm still not sure. I'm still not sure what happened. I got fired before we shot the pilot. And I was really devastated, because I loved that part of Roz. I think that's a great part. And I was excited to do something that wasn't, you know, an idiot girl. Because I had been playing a lot of idiot girls in, you know, guest spots here and there. So, no, that really hurt. But Perry Gilpin is so great, and I knew her. We auditioned together. So I actually was happy that she was doing it.
Boy, how do you end up being happy that she's doing it when she took the role that you wanted? I mean, that's hard posture to maintain, I think.
Well, you know what? She knew all those producers. She had worked with them before when we were both auditioning for it. And I took the role she wanted, and that was really due her, to be honest.
Right.
You know, and it was nice to see it go back to her. And it was hard, but at the same time, I am a firm believer, and I had a lot of friends telling me, you know, the truth is, when something like this happens, it's because it wasn't meant to be, and it's saving you for something else that you're supposed to be doing.
Lisa Kudrow is a star of Friends and the new movie Wonderland. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with actress Lisa Kudrow, one of the stars of Friends. She's starring in the new movie, Wonderland.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of Dow Osmond's The Stones of Summer, inspiration for the film Stone Reader, available at Barnes & Noble bookstores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by DK Publishing, publishers of Smithsonian Institution, The Story of the West, a history of the American West and its people. From the Sundance Channel, this month, Anatomy of a Scene explores the making of The Singing Detective, starring Robert Downey Jr. Listings at sundancechannel.com. And by Rodale Incorporated, publishers of Not Fade Away, A Short Life Well Lived by Lawrence Shames and Peter Barton. The book tells the story of Barton's maverick life and unique response to dying young, at bookstores everywhere.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to our interview with Lisa Kudrow. She's in the middle of the final season of Friends, and she's starring with Val Kilmer in the new movie Wonderland.
If we can talk a little bit about your formative years. Your father was a neurologist, and he studied migraines. Did you ever have migraines?
Well, first, my father was an internist who then specialized in headache.
Ah.
And did research in headache, important research. And my brother is a neurologist.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Who treats headache. Yeah.
Thank you.
Sure. Once in a while, nothing. I didn't have chronic headaches growing up. But I've experienced what a migraine is, yeah.
No, I think I read that you had worked with your father or doing research on migraines. Do I have that right?
Yes, you have that right. When I was in college, you know, I was a biology major, and my plan was to do research, not in the area of headache, but that was part of my plan. So after college, I worked with my father, helping him with research, and because I hadn't decided to be an actress yet, but it was creeping in at that point. And we actually did do a study. We looked at hemispheric dominance, and was it related to the various headache types.
So did you consider medicine instead of acting?
Medicine was brief, you know, in the beginning of college. But then I was really looking into doing, to studying evolutionary theory and more specifically areas of sociobiology and... the bottom line for me, I was really interested in the evolution of human psychology, seeing how environment and biology work together to inform the changes over time in our in our psychology.
So, how did acting win over that?
When I was little, I wanted to be an actress. It's so weird. I always wanted to be an actress, and I just put it on a shelf when I was in high school and college, really squelched any of those desires. And whenever I'd come back from college on a break, I'd get these little, like, whispers or feelings about, yeah, I could do this. I think you could do this. It's like, yeah, but you can't, you know, be an actual person that you'd respect and do this. So just put it away again and go back to school. Do something honorable. And when I moved back, it just overtook me. I don't know how else to say it. It just overtook me that I had to pursue acting. I could do it, and I wanted to do it.
Where did you start?
I started with John Lovitz, who I grew up with. That's my brother's best friend and like a brother to me. And I had seen him struggle, you know, for a long time, and finally he was working. He got on Saturday Night Live, and I just finally let him know, I think I'm going to pursue this now. And he said, great, go to the Groundlings. So I've taken a lot of acting classes. I studied it in college. I've never learned more than I learned from the Groundlings and doing improvisation.
When he told you to go there, did they just, like, let you in?
No, absolutely not. No, they called up and said, when I called them, they said, what's your experience? And I said, well, in junior high, and so they said, yeah, here, we're going to refer you to this teacher who we work with a lot. And she was a godsend. Her name's Cynthia Seghetti. And she was the best thing that could have happened to me.
How come?
Because she didn't take no for an answer. And embarrassment was not an option. You just had to do it. And it was the best thing that ever happened to me. And, you know, it's improvisation, and that could be scary. And some of the exercises look really silly, like lifting a disc, you know. And I thought, that's so actory and embarrassing. I just can't. And the second class, I came in late, and she was just, you know, talking everyone through it. She wasn't, like, warm and nurturing, although she was warm. But she was, come on, do it. You can do it. Stop laughing. We'll laugh. We'll tell you when it's funny. You know, just how to stay committed. She just forced you, sort of like with a gun to your head, mm-hmm. you know, on being louder and staying committed. And I'm watching these people lift a disc, and I'm so embarrassed for them, except for one guy who's doing it. And now I understand what being committed is. He was so committed that it wasn't embarrassing. He looked like he was lifting a disc. He wasn't overdoing it. He wasn't embarrassed. He wasn't commenting on it. He was just there acting like he's lifting a disc. And I understood what commitment was from that.
Is this a disc like a discus thrower?
There's nothing there. You're right. Pretending like, no, everyone's standing around in a circle and you're all working together to lift a disc.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm. So it's a group exercise.
Yeah. But there's this one guy who's doing it, and he's not embarrassing to me. And I thought, all right, well, I got to be friends with that guy. That's for sure. And it was Conan O'Brien.
Oh.
Yeah. So we became friends, you know, from that class on. We were very close friends.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. And so I just kind of stuck with him because I thought, okay, he's got a handle on this.
So, how come you saw yourself as a comic actor? How did you know that, at least at the beginning, it was going to be about comedy for you?
Because I thought, wow, you know, the people in comedy don't seem to take themselves as seriously. I could handle that. I think I could handle that, being around those people. A lot of it was just about who would I have to deal with if I'm going to do this career? And, you know, that was also a big deterrent for so many years before I decided to do it.
What were you afraid of in terms of the people?
Just
pretentiousness?
Not so much a pretentiousness as too otherworldly, too, you know, because I feel like they're genuine in their erroneous beliefs. That's how I felt about it, you know.
What were the erroneous beliefs?
I don't know, a little too just anything goes. Because I was a really rigid kid and, you know, young adult. Really rigid. And I'm not saying I was right back then, but that's just how I felt. Like, you know, these people are idiots, and I don't want to be one of them, and I don't want to be associated with them. What I came to find out was that they're not idiots, and everybody, and I, more than anyone else, could use a little lightening up, you know?
Was one of your fears about actors was that sense of, like, elevating craft to an almost, like, religious level?
Yes, thank you. That was exactly what it was.
And
yeah.
What was your problem with that?
It didn't ring true to me at the time. It just felt like somebody trying. Yeah, I think you were right when you said pretentious. I don't know why I rejected it so quickly. That
hostility.
Was unfair. Yeah, I don't know. It made me so angry at you. maybe that was part of it. It just didn't ring true. It was something that I just always rejected, and you know, I just lumped. I'm very black and white, and especially then. So I'd see an actor or an actress on a talk show and hate them, you know, and hate all their divorces and hate, you know, just how messed up they were and not seeing it, you know, behaving as if, and of course everyone would aspire to be me, you know, it really bothered me a lot.
My guest is Lisa Kudrow. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
My guest Lisa Kudrow is one of the stars of Friends, which is in its final season, and she's starring in the new movie, Wonderland. You became really famous for your role on Friends. I want to ask you about a movie role that you had a few years ago in The Opposite of Sex. And it's such a great performance in this movie.
Thank you.
And it's a terrific film in general. And it's an interesting character for you because it's a comedic character. It's comedy, but your character is really smart. What she isn't is very kind of emotionally intelligent. she's got a lot of like emotional problems, but she's very perceptive and very smart and very articulate.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about that character?
Yeah. Oh, I loved playing Lucia. You know, I recognized so much of myself in her because of that rigidity. You know, I was talking about in myself as a teenager and young adult, just I had all these rules and just sort of like an emotional disconnect, you know. And I don't know where and how Don Roos saw that in me, but, you know, he just offered me that role based on, I don't know what, Romeo and Michelle, how? Friends, how?
Huh.
But somehow he just thought, yeah, you could be her. I don't, and I still am not sure why.
And, you know, she in the movie, she's in love with a guy who turns out to be gay and falls in love with her brother. And before the movie opens, her brother has died of AIDS. So she thinks maybe there's still a chance with this other guy, which of course there isn't because he really is gay. And then his sister, played by Christina Ricci, comes to town and she's really nuts. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so you think of yourself in the movie as the real, like, sane person, not realizing, like, what your own craziness is.
Right.
Do you have a favorite scene from the film?
In terms of the script, there's a lot of them I like. I really liked that moment where she's kind of fed up with Bill when they're in Palm Springs and talking about how her mother was so sad for her gay brother because how alone he must be, what a lonely life it is to be gay, which she's saying to her single daughter, who's more alone than he is.
Right.
I don't know, you know, but, oh, there's so much going on in that scene. It's just chock full of stuff.
Well, let's hear it. This is Lisa Kudrow and Martin Donovan in a scene from The Opposite of Sex.
I mean, I could like, dance around you naked. Vagina, vagina, vagina. Does that word do anything for you?
I don't think it does much for anyone, gay or straight. It's too clinical. It's like dentifrice for toothpaste.
God, so ironic. Do you know what my mom said when she found out Tom was gay? She said, it's such a lonely life. She said that to the single straight girl. Isn't that funny? I don't know, I don't get sex.
You should get out more.
I mean, I don't understand sex. I don't get it, get it? Just, it seems like a lot of trouble for not much. Am I the only one that thinks this?
I don't think you're the tip of an iceberg, frankly.
No, I would rather have a back rub. You know, it lasts longer, and there's no fluids. You know, what's so great about that? It's like, hi, I'd like to blow my nose on your face. You know, you wouldn't like that, would you?
And after they do it, they never phone you.
That's a scene from The Opposite of Sex with Martin Donovan and my guest, Lisa Kudrow. Now, you've become a mother since working on Friends, which means that, you know, part of the time you were pregnant on the set. Was that difficult to deal with, either from, you know, the technical point of view or just, like, the physical aspect of it?
That was hard, technically and physically. In those days, you know, we were also shooting the show. We wouldn't be done till 1 or 2 in the morning sometimes. And I was just exhausted the whole 9 months. That was, you know, my pregnancy ailment was exhaustion.
Mm-hmm.
And a little nausea. But that part was really hard. And also, no one seeming to understand that I really had to sit down a lot. You know, I felt like I was always trying to remind people, like, but I need a chair.
Right.
But it's hard for me to stay up this late. And sometimes feeling like if I'd ask, and it's asking a lot because there's six of us, can I shoot out my scenes and then I can go home? Sometimes yes, a lot of times no.
So it's hard to draw the line between taking care of yourself and feeling like you're acting spoiled and asking for special treatment.
Yeah, yeah. And so it was hard. It was really hard. And then also just how you look. And they didn't really play the Phoebe is pregnant thing. I was still hiding it or trying to hide it for a while. And, you know, in the beginning, you look like you've just gained a lot of weight.
Right.
So that was hard.
Do you think that the other women characters on Friends have been more sexualized than your character has been?
Absolutely. Sure.
And is that because yours is the more kind of comedic?
No. I think it's because I'm not as sexual as they are. I mean, I'm not as... I don't project that as much as they do.
So you think it's about you, the actress, not about the character?
Yeah, I really do. I really do. You know, there's no end to the amount of dating and, you know, sexual experiences that Phoebe refers to. So the opportunity was definitely there, but I'm not comfortable doing that.
Mm-hmm.
It's not any kind of, you know, like moral belief or I'm against it. It's not that at all. I'm personally not comfortable with that. So, you know, I don't like photo shoots. We did one early on where this one photographer who does stuff, and he did that famous shot of Jennifer on the cover of Rolling Stone where you see like a fuzzy, blurry, part of her tushy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's just about the sexiest thing I'd ever seen. And I thought it was beautiful. And so we were all doing a shoot, the three girls, and it was that same photographer. I think it was before, you know, Jennifer's Rolling Stone cover, but he had us all doing different things that were kind of sexy and asked me to unbutton my top and keep unbuttoning it and opening it up just a little more. And as I was doing it, it felt awful to me. I didn't like the way it felt at all. I felt like taken advantage of.
Mm-hmm.
I just did, and I thought, what is this? All of a sudden, I'm like I don't know. It didn't feel right. I'm like a sex performer right now.
Right.
I have to be a sex performer for this photo shoot, and I wasn't comfortable with it.
So what'd you do? Did you say you're not comfortable and then button your shirt back up? Or did you say, well, you know, they're asking me to do this, and I'll be a good sport even though I don't feel comfortable?
I was trying, it was more of, get comfortable with this, Lisa. Come on. Don't, you know, stop that prejudice you have against everything. Maybe this is part of your old way of thinking, you know. And I tried, and I unbuttoned it, and I opened it a little, and I tried, and, you know, it just didn't feel comfortable. And the kind of face you have to make to look sexy.
Oh, like, yeah.
You know, opening your mouth a little and your eyes get really big and you purse your lips. That's like a comedy bit to me. And I've even done it as jokes in photo shoots or Polaroids. I always, as a joke, do this. To me, it's a crazy face.
Uh-huh.
And it looks okay. It doesn't look crazy.
That sexual pout.
Yeah, and it doesn't look crazy. It looks like what all these women look like when they look really sexy or doing these photographs. So now when I see those, I think, wow, the amount of contortion it took me to achieve that. I can't believe that's what you do without even thinking twice about it. Huh.
That's really funny. Do you know people who do that naturally, or do you think that whole style of sexual allure is almost always pure acting?
Oh, I think there are people who it's pretty natural for.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my husband has a pout to him, and he's sexy, and that's natural, can't help it. Everyone in his family, they're all French, you know, they just are sexy, and it's no act. But, yeah, so there are people like that. I know there are. But then there are others who, come on. Like, I know what you had to do to achieve that face and that arch, and it's just, like, so unnatural to me. Unless you're in, you know, a bedroom.
Well, good luck with the new movie and good luck with the final season of Friends. It's just been such a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lisa Kudrow. She's in the middle of the final season of Friends, and she's starring in the new film Wonderland. This is Fresh Air.
We never know what's next on Fresh Air. One day our guest is an actress, another it's a journalist just back from Iraq. We try to present a mix of entertainment and interviews with experts who can help explain the complicated issues we face today. But whatever the subject of the day is, one thing remains the same. Fresh Air would not be possible without the support of our listeners. Please call with a pledge. Thank you. Martha Gellhorn looked like a movie star, could curse like a sailor, and held her own along with Edward R. Murrow and Ernie Pyle in the masculine world of war reporting. In a new biography, simply called Gellhorn, celebrated biographer Carolyn Moorhead takes stock of Martha Gellhorn, who seems to have never met an obstacle she couldn't vault herself over. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
There was a time, not so very long ago, when dames walked the earth. Dames were a special breed of woman, part Girl Scout, part femme fatale. They were smart, self-reliant, and sexually liberated. Lillian Hellman was a dame, and so was Katharine Hepburn, on screen and in life. But perhaps the greatest dame of them all is the one now least familiar to the public, Martha Gellhorn. If most people recognize her name at all, they know her as one of Ernest Hemingway's wives, his third, in fact. Gellhorn, who stayed married to Hemingway for less than 5 years, came to loathe the man. She once confided to a friend that he needed me to run his house and to copulate on. When I thought I'd go mad from loneliness and boredom, I slipped off to war. War was Gellhorn's element. She was a journalist, most spectacularly a war correspondent, who dodged bombs during the Spanish Civil War, where she and Hemingway first became an item, and who managed to land unauthorized on Omaha Beach just hours after D-Day by hiding in the locked bathroom of a hospital ship. In 1966, at age 58, Gellhorn paid her own travel expenses to Vietnam, where she wrote some of the earliest and sternest criticisms of the war. In her enthralling new biography called Gellhorn, Caroline Moorhead briskly extracts Gellhorn from Hemingway's shadow, and as a parting shot, convincingly argues that, of the two, Gellhorn was both the better journalist and had the bigger pair of cojones. Surely the greatest danger any biography of Gellhorn's must face is that of simply falling limp with admiration before such a titanic creature. But Moorhead, who knew Gellhorn in her old age, emulates Gellhorn in her rigorous addiction to truth-telling. The result is a nuanced and compelling portrait of a woman who, like many of her generation, was not given to psychological introspection. Gellhorn despised self-pity, a trait she disliked in contemporary feminism, and surrounded herself with friends of a feather she called non-moaners, among them Eleanor Roosevelt, H.G. Wells, and the photographer Robert Capa. Gellhorn also knew herself to be an erratic, sometimes cruel mother to her son Sandy, and at the core, sexually and emotionally remote from her two husbands and numerous lovers. But those and other flaws acknowledged, what a life Gellhorn made for herself. Born in 1908 to an upper-class, half-Jewish family in St. Louis, Gellhorn inherited her suffragist mother's spunk and progressive politics. After a brief stint at college, she set off at the end of the Roaring Twenties for Paris to become a writer. She had $75 in her pocket, a typewriter, and two suitcases. She was also startlingly beautiful, blonde and leggy, and throughout her life, Gellhorn unapologetically used her looks. After a bumpy education in politics and romance in France, Gellhorn came back to the United States to travel alone up and down the eastern seaboard and write investigative reports about textile mill workers for Roosevelt's Federal Emergency Relief Administration. In those reports, Gellhorn found her trademark voice of barely contained fury against injustice. It's that voice, Moorhead says, that distinguished Gellhorn's best journalism for the next 60 years. In her accounts of lynchings in this country, the bombing of Guernica, the Russian invasion of Finland, the liberation of Dachau, the McCarthy witch hunts, the formation of the State of Israel, and on and on. One of the unexpected fascinations of this biography is its long look at how a dame like Gellhorn coped with old age. At 89, a cancer-ridden Gellhorn decided to end her life with a pill. It's an act to neither decry nor admire, but it is of a piece with Gellhorn's almost fearsome determination to control her own destiny. Gellhorn once said, "You can do anything you like if you are willing to pay the full price for it." Throughout her superb biography, Moorhead chronicles Gellhorn's triumphs and the bills that always came due.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Gellhorn, A 20th Century Life by Carolyn Moorhead. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, are we asking too much of our pets? Are dogs taking the emotional place of family or friends? And is it putting too much pressure on the animals? We talk with John Katz, author of The New Work of Dogs. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.